Welcome to the deep dive. Okay, so today we're talking about something, well, maybe a little squirmy, but it's really important.
Definitely squirmy for some, yeah.
Right. This hidden world living inside us. We've got a bunch of sources you sent over, including insights from a clinical microbiologist looking into all the recent buzz around parasites.
Mm-hmm. The whole deworming trend links to chronic illness.
Exactly. And even cancer. Which is pretty bold.
It is.
So our mission today really is to cut through that noise.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to unpack this material, look at the science, and try to figure out what's actually going on.
Yeah.
And separate the hype from the actual evidence.
Sounds good. It's definitely a topic that needs some real clarification.
Okay, let's unpack this then. It feels like parasites are suddenly everywhere online, but I mean, humans and parasites, we go way back, right? This isn't new.
Oh, absolutely not. Millennia. We've coexisted for ages. And parasitic infections, still incredibly common across the globe. But what's interesting and what the sources really highlight is how often they're missed in places like, say, the U.S. or Western Europe. Underdiagnosed is the word they use.
Why is that? Do we just assume they're not here?
Kind of. There's this assumption, yeah, that they're mostly tropical diseases or something you only pick up traveling.
Ah, the old traveler's bug idea.
Exactly. And that mindset, according to the material, means we might be overlooking them when they're right here. It creates a blind spot.
Okay, so if they are here, not just abroad, how are these little hitchhikers, microscopic or sometimes, you know, not microscopic, how are they getting in? What do the sources say?
Well, they point to pretty common routes, actually. Contaminated water is a big one.
Okay.
Undercooked meat. That's another classic. Unwashed fruits and veggies.
Huh?
Even just contact with soil that's contaminated.
Soil, like gardening or walking barefoot.
Yep, exactly that. And the sources list some of the usual suspects you might find. Things like pinworms, various roundworms, tapeworms. And then the single-celled ones, the protozoa, like Giardia.
Right, Giardia. I've heard of that one. Okay, so this is where it gets a bit unsettling for me. The idea that some of these can just like move in and set up shop without you even knowing, is that really a thing?
It is, unfortunately. And it's a really key point in the material we looked at. Many parasites are masters of disguise, you could say. They're very good at evading our immune system.
How?
Well, they can live inside us for years, even decades, apparently, without causing any really obvious symptoms.
Years, decades. That's kind of hard to wrap your head around. How do they manage that?
Ooh, they've evolved all sorts of clever strategies. Some form a cysts to hide. Some actively suppress our immune response in their little neighborhood. Others just move into tissues where the immune system isn't patrolling quite as heavily.
Sneaky.
Very. The sources give examples like the pork tapeworm, Tanysulium. When its larvae get into your tissues, they can just sit there totally silent for years.
Wow.
Then there's one called Strongyloides stercoralis. It's a type of roundworm. And it's particularly insidious because it can auto-infect.
Auto-infect? What does that mean?
It means it can complete its whole life cycle inside you. So it can keep reinfecting you from within, potentially for decades, without you ever getting re-exposed from the outside.
That's not pleasant.
Not pleasant at all. And another one mentioned is Toxocara chinus. We often get that one from dogs, actually. Its larvae can travel through your organs.
Through your organs?
Yeah. It causes something called visceral larva migrans, basically migrating larvae inside you. And then they can just become dormant, latent, waiting.
Good grief.
And even something common like Blastocystis hominis, which is a protozoan often found in the gut. For lots of people, it causes no symptoms at all. For others, though, it's linked to quite a bit of gut discomfort. It varies.
So it's a real spectrum. Silent squatters for some, but for others, they do make their presence known eventually.
Exactly. And the symptoms, if they do appear, are all over the place. It really depends on the specific parasite and where it sets up shop.
What kind of things did the sources mention?
Things like persistent itching, especially that nighttime anal itching classic for pinworms. Bloating, chronic fatigue that you just can't explain, maybe anemia. Or sometimes you see this specific type of white blood cell. Eosinophils go up on a blood test. That can be a clue.
Eosinophils, okay.
But again, the key thing is you might have absolutely zero symptoms. That possibility is crucial here.
Okay, right. Let's pivot to the really big claim here, the one that gets a lot of attention. The parasite-cancer connection. Is there, like, actual scientific weight behind this, or is it more speculative?
Okay, yeah. This is where digging into the sources gets really interesting. It's definitely not just speculation. There is evidence. Enough that some pretty major health organizations are paying attention.
Major how? Like who?
Well, like the International Agency for Research on Cancer, the IARC. part of the World Health Organization. They actually classify several specific parasitic infections as group 1 carcinogens.
Group 1. Hang on. Isn't that the highest level? Like tobacco smoke, asbestos?
Yep.
That category.
That's the one. Exactly. They don't put things in group 1 lightly. It means there's sufficient evidence of carcinogenicity in humans.
Wow. Okay. So which parasites are we talking about here? What did the sources name?
The sources specifically flagged a few. There's Schistosoma haematobium. It's a type of blood fluke common in parts of Africa and the Middle East. It's strongly linked with bladder cancer.
Okay.
And then there are two types of liver flukes, Opisthoctis viverini and Clonorchis sinensis, mostly found in Southeast Asia. There are significant risk factors for a type of bile duct cancer called cholangiocarcinoma.
Liver flukes causing bile duct cancer. Bladder flukes causing bladder cancer. How does that work? How does a worm or a fluke actually cause cancer? What's the mechanism described?
Yeah, what's fascinating here, based on the reading, is how it seems to happen. It's generally not the parasite itself being, like, inherently cancerous. It's more about the long-term consequences of it being there.
Okay, like what?
Chronic irritation. Persistent inflammation. The parasite living there for years and years constantly irritates the surrounding tissue. This triggers an ongoing inflammatory response.
Right. Inflammation comes up a lot with chronic disease.
Exactly. And the parasite also often manipulates or modulates the local immune response, sometimes suppressing it to protect itself. Over time, this chronic inflammation, immune weirdness, and the constant cycle of cell damage and repair, it can lead to DNA damage, mutations, and changes in how cells grow and divide. Eventually, that can tip over into cancer.
So it's a slow burn, basically, years of irritation and inflammation.
That seems to be the main proposed mechanism. It really shows how these organisms we might live with for a long time can subtly, chronically mess with our cellular health.
Yeah, that makes a disturbing amount of sense. Okay, so given these potential long-term risks, even the cancer link, you can see why people might jump on the idea of deworming just for general health, right?
Yeah.
But what did the sources, especially the clinical expert perspective, say about that trend? It's just like routine deworming a good idea for everyone.
This raises an important question, definitely. And this is where the material provided some really crucial nuance. Blanket deworming, just taking antiparasitic drugs without a confirmed diagnosis, especially in healthy adults in low prevalence areas, is explicitly stated as not standard medical practice.
So popping a dewormer just in case isn't really recommended by mainstream medicine?
Not as a general preventative, no. The current evidence and guidelines just don't support that approach for everybody. However.
Ah, there's a however.
There is. The sources did mention specific situations where what's called empirical treatment, so treating based on suspicion without a confirmed test, might be considered.
Like when?
Typically in regions where parasitic infections are known to be extremely common, a very high parasitic load in the population, or sometimes in an individual who has really persistent, unexplained symptoms like chronic gut issues or those high eosinophils we mentioned, where the doctor has a strong clinical suspicion.
But it's a judgment call based on risk and symptoms, not just something everyone should do.
Exactly. It's based on clinical evaluation, not a broad public health recommendation for generally healthy adults in, say, North America or Europe.
Okay. That distinction is important. So if a parasite is suspected or actually confirmed by a test, what are the options for getting rid of it? I know there's loads online about natural remedies, but also standard drugs. What do the sources cover?
They touched on both sides. Yeah. On the natural front, they mentioned several things that have at least some evidence or a long history of traditional use. Pumpkin seeds came up.
Pumpkin seeds. Really?
Yeah. Apparently, they contain something called cucurbitacin, which is thought to paralyze certain types of worms. Garlic also has demonstrated anti-parasitic activity, but often that's in vitro, meaning in lab studies.
Okay, so maybe not as proven in humans yet.
Right. Then you have things like black walnut hull and wormwood. Their traditional remedies show some promise in studies, but the sources were very clear about including a strong caution.
Caution why?
They can be potent, potentially toxic if used incorrectly or in high doses, especially for kids, and definitely need care if someone has liver or kidney problems. Supervision is recommended. Papaya seeds were also mentioned. They have enzymes with anthelmintic properties, meaning they fight worms.
So the natural stuff isn't necessarily risk-free either.
Definitely not. That was a key message. Natural doesn't automatically mean safe for everyone in any amount. You still need to be careful and ideally get guidance.
Makes sense. And what about the pharmaceutical drugs?
The sources mentioned the standard, well-established ones, drugs like albendazole, mebendazole, ivermectin. These are often the first-line treatment for many common worm infections. They've been used for a long time.
And are they generally safe?
They're considered to have a strong safety profile, but, and this is important when used appropriately. That means the right drug for the right parasite at the right dose under medical supervision. Prescription is usually needed for a reason.
Right. Okay, this has been, wow, quite a journey. From these hidden infections maybe living unnoticed for decades to the really serious potential links with cancer, and then sorting through the treatment options and the whole deworming debate. If we try to sort of boil it all down, what are the main takeaways from this deep dive into the source material? What's the bottom line for someone listening?
I think there are two main things, really. First, yes, parasites are real. They are likely underdiagnosed in many places we don't typically associate them with. And yes, they can contribute to significant health problems, including those established links to certain cancers by major health bodies like the IARC. That part is important to acknowledge.
Okay, so awareness is key, but what's the second part?
The second part is the counterpoint. It's just as critical to understand that not every single unexplained symptom, especially not every gut issue, is automatically caused by a parasite. We shouldn't jump to that conclusion without evidence.
So it's that balance again. Be aware, but don't assume.
Exactly. Be aware of the possibility. Absolutely. Talk to your doctor if you have persistent symptoms that worry you, or if you have a relevant travel history or risk factors, but rely on, evidence-based diagnosis and treatment. Don't just follow trends like blanket deworming without a proper assessment.
And you mentioned earlier that the tools for diagnosis are better now.
Yes, that's the good news highlighted in the sources. Diagnostic tools have improved a lot. Things like stool PCR tests, which are super sensitive and can detect parasite DNA, or serology tests looking for antibodies in the blood. These make getting an accurate diagnosis much more possible than it used to be with just, say, traditional microscopy alone.
That's huge. Better tools mean clearer answers. Okay, so we've covered a lot of ground. We started with acknowledging this ancient relationship between humans and parasites, how some can hide out for so long. They're really quite startling links to cancer for certain types, and then navigating the whole treatment and deworming picture. It really makes you think, doesn't it? Knowing these organisms have been with us, sometimes silently, for potentially our whole lives, maybe even for generations, and seeing how our understanding of their impact is shifting as our tools get better. It leads to a bigger question, I think.
Like what?
Well, what other hidden factors might be out there? In our environment, inside our own bodies, maybe even baked into our long evolutionary history with microbes and parasites. Factors that are subtly influencing chronic conditions, things we're only just starting to connect the dots on now.
That's a profound thought. What else are we missing simply because we haven't developed the right lens to see it yet?
Exactly. What else is lurking, just waiting for the right diagnostic key to unlock our understanding? Something to ponder. Until next time, stay curious, stay critical, and stay well.
This podcast is for educational purposes only and is not a substitute for professional medical advice. Always consult a licensed healthcare provider before beginning any treatment.